Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to Talking Business, a podcast produced in Melbourne, Australia. The podcast is available on the Acast site, my own website, the Apple Podcast Store, or wherever you go to get your podcasts. Or you can get it at the Business Acumen website at www.businessacumen.biz or at Banking Day. For the most exclusive access to leading economists and business leaders from around the world, subscribe to Talking Business from my website, leongettler.com. I am Leon Gettler. My job is to review and monitor the week's news in business, finance and economics. I bring it all to you every week. This is episode number 7 in our series for 2024, and today's date is Friday, March the 15th. First, I'll be talking to Tim Rosanis, Managing Director of peer-to-peer car-sharing pioneer Turo and former Head of Growth for Uber Retail. He's well-positioned to talk about the rise of a sharing economy as Aussies continue to battle changing economic conditions. And I'll be talking to Rabobank economist Michael Ivory about the Chinese economy in the year of a dragon. But first, let's talk to Tim Rosanis.
Tim, you now run Turo. And so tell us about the peer-to-peer car sharing in Australia. How does it work?
Yeah, thanks, Leon. Turo is the world's largest car sharing, peer-to-peer car sharing marketplace. And so what that means is guests can book a large selection of vehicles on the platform, really any kind of vehicle that they want, whether it's an SUV or a sedan, a normal car or a luxury car, an EV. We've got a huge amount of selection here in Australia, but also in our other markets globally. We're in the UK, the US, Canada, and we've acquired a business in France. And so it's powered by a community of hosts who place their vehicles on the platform to share them and monetizing the assets that would otherwise sit idle in their driveway, sometimes upwards of 90% of the time, monetizing them, turning it into a small business so that they can share their cars and provide a new mobility option for people who need to get around town.
And make themselves a nice little business on the side.
Yeah, exactly. Some people treat it as a side hustle, you could call it. So we've got hosts who have one or two cars and they might get, you know, one booking every couple of days or a couple of bookings a week. And it's just a good way of offsetting the cost of car ownership. And we know that owning a car in Australia is actually, you know, $5,000 to $10,000 worth of expenses every year, depending on whether you have a car loan or whether it's an EV versus a petrol vehicle. And so it's an expensive operation owning a car. And so even just for a consumer host who has one or two cars on the platform, it's a good way of offsetting those costs. And then we have what we call business hosts or professional hosts who might have more than two, sometimes more than 10 vehicles in their fleet, renting those cars out on Turo. And that's where, you know, it's a really legitimate business where people can be making tens of thousands of dollars every year. We've got hosts in the US who are clearing millions of dollars a year who have really significant operations and very much, you know, I guess in some ways creating an additional way of monetizing an asset that might otherwise be owned by a big traditional car rental conglomerate, and instead shifting the benefit of that asset to the local community. So we've got hosts who came for our launch in Australia, for example, who's got, you know, significant fleet in Hawaii. And if you want a Jeep in kind of anywhere in Hawaii, you book it on Turo, and that's his business. He's got tens of vehicles and making, you know, significant revenue every year as a result of the Turo platform. So it's definitely great that we've been able to launch it here in Australia.
Well, I mean, what's interesting with that is that, I mean, if people are putting up 10 vehicles, you would say that those people are actually running businesses that can afford 10 vehicles. So it's a side hustle to their business, or it's an extra revenue stream to their business.
Yeah, or it's the core of their business. We've got lots of small car rental operators in Australia who might have their own websites and driving traffic to their own page, who then are also putting their cars onto Turo and using the kind of network effect of our global brand to get access to all of the consumers that are coming through our channels, whether they be international travelers or we're investing pretty heavily in our marketing efforts here in Australia. So we're also seeing a lot of people going from one city to another and using Turo. And so, yeah, very much people who have decided that the business that they want to be in is the business of sharing cars. And when you think about it, if you're someone new to Australia, one of the first things that you do when you get out of the airport, you kind of land in Sydney or Melbourne or really anywhere around the country from overseas, one of the first things that you do, because we're such an expansive country, it's very hard to get around without a car. And there's still a lot of work to be done on the public transportation infrastructure in this country. And so a lot of the first experience that people have is going and getting a car for their trip. And so you think about the differences between traditional car rental, where you might have to go to a shuttle and you wait in line for 20 minutes for your turn, and then they give you the keys to the car, but it's not a car that you actually booked. You booked an economy vehicle, but they don't have any left, so they gave you a compact vehicle. That's a very different experience to the hospitality of Turo, where a host who runs that business might actually drop the car at the gate. So maybe not picking you up off the tarmac, that would be pretty luxurious. But as you exit the airport, you have the car pull up and they hand you the keys and they check your driver's license, you take some photos of the car, and then they give you the car and that's it. And it's a significantly superior experience. And the host, they live in the location where you're traveling. So they'll, you're in Melbourne, they ask you, hey, where are you off to? Down to Lawn, you're on the Great Ocean Road, taking a nice road trip. They can kind of give you advice about the destination that you're traveling to. And so it's just much more hospitable, we think.
Now, just say I'm just an ordinary person, I'm not a business, and I'm renting out my car or offering my car on Turo. How much could I expect to make per year?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It really depends on a whole variety of factors. So what kind of car do you have? How much availability do you have in the course of the month? Is it available 100% of the time, or is it available 20, 30% of the time? And then you get to set your own price. And so for us, it's very much about giving flexibility to people to run their kind of side hustle or their business in the way that they see fit. We're still very early on in our development of the market here in Australia, so the stats are probably not significant enough to share just yet. But in other markets, we're seeing an average of $19,000 from hosts who are really treating Turo like a business per year. And we think that's a pretty significant way of offsetting not just the cost of car ownership, but then making a buck on the top of an asset that you've already spent money to purchase. And then, when you compare that to, some of the other types of side hustles that you could have, whether it's renting out a home or gig economy as an option for people who are looking for additional income. We believe that putting a car onto Turo is a fairly accessible and scalable business to run. I mean, buying a place down the coast, unfortunately, isn't as affordable as it used to be. Or buying an apartment in Sydney or Melbourne, again, pretty expensive. And the barriers to entry for just normal Australians to be able to do that are fairly high. But buying a car is something, we've got almost more cars than people in Australia. And so buying a car is especially in the secondary market, not quite as difficult. And then monetizing it by putting onto a car sharing platform, again, is really accessible. And then the scaling, when you think about compared to the gig economy, where if you're a ride sharing driver or a delivery partner, that's your time. The asset that's being monetized there is your time. You have to be in the car to drop someone at the airport. You have to be on a motorbike to deliver their burgers to their house. But sharing a car is very different. All you have to do is give them the keys, and then they might book your car for a week or a month, and you're making money on that asset while still spending time however you want to spend your time. And so we think it's just a much more scalable and economically beneficial way of starting a side hustle.
Now, the interesting part is a lot of these car sales figures aren't looking that good over the years, and a lot of fewer people are now buying cars. And so would Turo be a substitute for that?
Yeah, fewer people are buying cars. It's a complicated question. I believe the figures, we can send through the numbers afterwards, but I believe the figures are that car sales are still increasing year over year, but the long-term projections, there was a report released by McKinsey recently, the long-term projections are that with a whole variety of different mobility options now, like car sharing, micro mobility, bikes and scooters, ride sharing, and the like, we will actually see medium to long term a decrease in the growth of new car sales. And if something like a shift from traditional car rental to car sharing occurs, one of the biggest buyers of new vehicles globally are traditional car rental companies. And so if you start to see a power dynamic shift towards car sharing providers, that's a more efficient use of the billions of cars that we have on the planet, because they're not sitting there in the depot. They're kind of being optimized for use, both personal use and professional use, in the community. And so we believe long-term that's a much better way of building the ecosystem with vehicles and mobility globally.
Okay. And of course, Turo's only been going for a small while in Australia. So it's very small compared to the market overseas. So what sort of growth do you see happening?
Yeah, we've only been in market, to your point, since the end of November. We launched late last year. And thankfully, Australia has been really good to us, and we've exceeded all the expectations that we had for our launch here in Australia. So far, so good. In other markets, Turo is, if you look at the US, the UK, Canada in particular, as well as the business that we acquired in France, Turo is very much in the vernacular as a legitimate alternative to traditional car rental and significant businesses in those markets. And so it's our intention to become a significant business here in Australia as well. We're investing significantly and have a local team that's growing, and our host community is growing as well. We last week had events for our host community in Sydney and Melbourne, where we brought them in and, you know, had some drinks and some food and just had really strong engagement, got good feedback from them. And, you know, in the large part, hosts are intending to build their businesses on Turo and to themselves invest in creating larger businesses here. So we see Australia as a deeply strategic market for us. You know, Australia is obviously an iconic tourism destination for people who live here and also for people overseas. And so we're starting to see, if you look at the tourism numbers, especially now with China opening its borders again for Chinese travelers to depart the country again, we expect to see passenger numbers increasing and tourism numbers increasing in Australia now. And what that means is, yeah, our intention is to grow this business here in Australia, no doubt going to be kind of well supported by the market. And the type of options that you can get for unique selection on Turo is also growing. So if you think even just about EVs specifically, if you want to try an electric vehicle for the first time, you're thinking about buying one when you upgrade to a new car next, and you can come to Turo and have an extended test drive, not just 30 minutes from the car dealership, but multiple days, or take on a holiday, or experience what it actually looks like to own an EV with BYDs and Polestars and Teslas and Nissan Leafs. We've got a Porsche Taycan, I think, in Melbourne. Lots of different options. It's pretty cool. And so just a new way of being able to experience not just EVs. Obviously, we've got lots of other cars as well, but far superior, we believe, to just getting some traditional, you know, normal car. Although we have those as well, because obviously people still have use for that type of vehicle too.
Well, Tim, it's been great talking to you, and wishing Turo all the best. Thank you.
Thank you, Leon. Really nice to talk to you. Cheers.
And now let's talk to Rabobank economist Michael Ivory.
Well, Michael, how's the Chinese economy going in the year of a dragon? I've noticed the Hong Kong court has liquidated Evergrande.
They have. If you wanted to try and make a year of the dragon pun, which is kind of obligatory in a very dry industry, I would probably be looking backwards to say something like Puff the Magic Dragon, in that many people are hoping you're going to see it roaring and breathing fire. And as I have said consistently, I hope you will remember, over all the years that we've been talking, nothing to see here, move along. There isn't going to be a recovery, not in the way that everyone has been hoping.
The property markets are still underperforming there.
That's a dramatic understatement. The property market is flat as a pancake and is extremely unlikely to ever come back. Partly that's because property was and is ludicrously overpriced, was and is ludicrously oversupplied. But more importantly, again, as I've stressed many times over the years, unlike Australia, and I know it's really hard for Australians to get their head around this, the government there doesn't want to have an overpriced property market as the basis for economic growth. It finds it destabilizing, massively increases economic and socio-political inequality, and has got nothing to do with what they're interested in, which is actual physical production of goods. And so while you get very tentative short-term steps here, there, or everywhere to try and ameliorate this downturn, structurally, from the highest levels, you know, of the party on down and out, there is no attempt to try and broadly reflate in exactly the same way the Australians would expect the Australian government to do, were you to see property prices drop drastically and turnover in the market collapse to the point when no one's really buying or selling.
So what does that mean for the Chinese economy moving into 2024?
Well, exactly what one would expect. Growth is now at a much lower level. But given how much they have overbuilt most key infrastructure and particularly property, that's entirely logical and sensible. And we have to adjust to an economy which is growing at a much more natural rather than artificially juiced rate. And for many people exporting to China, that means that the demand they're used to seeing, instead of looking like an exponential line going upwards, now it's a very flat line. And that's if you're lucky. For some people, it's actually down. That's likely to be the state of play going forward. And conversely, China is now putting all the energies that it used to throw into property into exporting even more. The entire world is now seeing a flood of excellent quality, low-priced Chinese electric vehicles, for example. Now, some countries are going to swallow them whole and say, thank you, that helps our consumers have greater spending power. Just overnight, we've seen the White House say they have no intention of doing that. The national security concerns, which, by the way, purely objectively, I have to say, are completely valid. When you have the Internet of Things and you have objects like automobiles, which are now completely wired to the Internet, they can be hacked. They can be controlled. All your data can be monitored. That's not a China-specific thing. That's also true for any Western company. But when it comes to China, obviously, that will be a national security concern. And the American move suggests that there may be an outright ban on those vehicles, which then leaves China putting all its energies from property into exporting of these kind of goods and then finding out it can't sell them to the West either, which creates serious problems.
And youth unemployment is in the 20s.
Well, truth be told, we don't know, because it was in the high 20s. Then they stopped publishing it. Then they started republishing it again, and it's about 10 percentage points better than it was. So I think you can hold your nose when you look at most Australian data, to be honest. You can definitely hold your nose and cover one of your eyes when you look at American data, and you're probably better off covering both your eyes when you look at the Chinese data. But, you know, all you need to understand fundamentally, as I've said repeatedly over the years here, is that the rapid Chinese growth model that they had was on one level credit driven, and that was always going to run out. And on the other level, politically unsustainable in a Marxist-Leninist, Maoist, Xi Jinping economy, which is concerned with inequality and making sure that some parts of society and the country don't pull away from the others, which, when we look at the West, is a serious, serious problem in our societies, which we are doing nothing at all, nothing to deal with. And China is absolutely determined to deal with it, even if it has economic consequences.
Yeah, but they'll need distractions, wouldn't they, from their economic woes?
Distractions. Well, if we're going to think three-dimensionally rather than two-dimensionally, I think I know what you're alluding to. And that's certainly a risk. I mean, Bloomberg today, which is obviously quite a conservative media source, particularly given that their Asian headquarters is in Hong Kong. And if I just turn to what was on the front page just a second ago, let me just check that it's still there and hasn't moved. It was, where are we? Yep, discontent with a picture of Xi Jinping on the front page of Bloomberg. Xi's rule over China's economy is spurring unrest. Now, I'm pretty staggered they've had the audacity to print that story. I don't see any signs of unrest in China. And obviously, China is not an economy or a state that's going to tolerate unrest if it sees it, for many obvious reasons. So distractions, if we're talking externally, I think you're probably aware of the kind of headlines you've seen in the Aussie press recently and where speculation would go. But I think the more important point to focus on is that they're not going to blink. You know, while China is currently under the current, you know, system that it is, they're not going to suddenly say, right, let's try and bail everything out. Let's try and go back to the way things were. Let's try and juice GDP by another couple of percentage points a year, which is exactly what we would do in the West. And they're not going to do it.
So their growth rate is said to be around now, probably around 5% rather than extraordinarily high.
Yeah, I mean, that's completely artificial, that figure. As I said, really, you can't take that data seriously when you look at all the moving parts of the economy which aren't moving. Now, that doesn't mean everything's bad. I mean, there are, you know, in an economy that size or that scale, of course, there are areas of great strength. And as I said, auto exports is one of them, but that doesn't give you 5% growth in an economy that size. And green exports like solar panels, et cetera, and inverters for solar panels, they're obviously serious, you know, pieces of technology that China's selling well, but they don't give you 5% growth. But those are the figures we're going to see. I think that's the more important thing, that you have to recognize that whatever number they are putting on the current economic performance is where growth will stay from now on. They can label it however they want. That's what it will be.
But it will certainly be lower than what's been before.
Well, undoubtedly, in that there simply isn't the artificial extra growth that you get from allowing, you know, a certain part of the population demographically and geographically to make a lot of paper money from speculating on completely fictitious, unrealistic asset prices. And again, I'm not trying to have a go at Australia. I'd say the same thing in America and in the UK, right the way across the Western world. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, how China's addressing it, one may have issues with for various different reasons. And some of those concerns are valid. But if you take a big step back, and I try and be genuinely neutral when I do my analysis here, rather than seeing things either just through a Western lens.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Lens, or just through a, you know, a Chinese flag waving lens. If you take a big picture, long run view, is what we're doing really any more sensible? I think there are serious questions to be asked there.
What about Chinese importing stuff, like for example iron ore? Was that going to continue?
Well, that's a key one for Australia. Obviously, commodity prices in general have been under pressure, and iron ore obviously isn't going to be needed on the same scale going forwards if property and infrastructure have already been built out for generations ahead, which they have. I think there's a lot further downside, you know, for the Australia export basket to China going forward in general. Whether that's fast or slow remains to be seen. And that does link back, at least indirectly, to what you're alluding to in terms of distractions, which is the more that we start to see geopolitical discontent between the West and China, which isn't going away at all, and with election season coming up in the US, it's likely to get worse, the more you are likely to see pressures building over time for China to say, right, well, you know, we don't want to be reliant on foreign sources of these imports, or we just don't need them as much, or we're going to be buying them from Africa instead, or we'll insist on buying them in renminbi, which will, of course, disrupt Australia's ability to export to them, provided they're under the US defense umbrella, which they currently are. So if you're planning further down the line and you're just thinking you can continue everything that's been done for the past couple of decades, and that's Australia's future, my message has been over and over again, think again. History doesn't run in a straight line like that. I know it's unpopular. It has been right. It will be right again. And it's not actually a hard call to make, because history does not continue in only one direction.
And this will last for how long?
Well, forever. History goes on forever. You know, the call that history will keep changing will last forever. But as I said, you know, as far as my lifetime and your lifetime are concerned, and the lifetimes of people listening, don't expect any change. You know, unless something dramatic happens, and you and I will be talking immediately if it does, take this to be the direction of travel. But that itself, that unwinding of everything that we saw winding up for a couple of decades, will take at least a couple of decades. But it may be done more quickly and in a more short, sharp shot manner.
And certainly, while Xi Jinping remains in power, we're going to see that, and there's no sign of him leaving.
Well, no. I mean, it's not an electoral democracy, obviously. It calls itself a democracy, but it's not one in the way that we understand it. And provided his health is good, if you look at how long some leaders in some countries are around for, he could be around for, you know, another 10 years at least, possibly for the rest of his life, which could be, let's say, maybe another 20 years. So from a business perspective, I think the message is clear, and I hope very simple. Don't think things just suddenly snap back to the way they were. If you're in a position where you can benefit right now from how things are, and they still look like the way they were, great, enjoy that, but don't presume it will last forever. Make sure you've got a plan B and a plan C.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
So what's happening in the news? Well, US inflation unexpectedly increased to 3.2% last month, highlighting the challenge faced by the Federal Reserve in the last mile of its fight against rising prices. Economists polled by Bloomberg had expected annual consumer price inflation to remain unchanged from January's rate of 3.1%. But Tuesday's rise, largely stoked by services such as motor insurance and health, triggered warnings that the Fed may have to wait longer than previously expected before cutting interest rates from their current 23-year high. It also dents Biden's re-election chances. And Credit Watch has warned more businesses will go under in the coming months as cost pressures from interest rates, inflation, wages and labour shortages bite deeper, with payments defaults hitting a record high in February. Credit Watch said conditions would get more difficult and it believed up to 4 cuts to the cash rate would be needed before consumers start to feel comfortable making discretionary purchases. However, this was unlikely to be until early 2025. The Credit Watch Business Risks Index, BRI, showed that payment defaults from business-to-business transactions were at record highs, up about 50% in the past year to 122, as companies face lower consumer demand. And market heavyweights say interest rates may stay higher for longer, amid structural economic changes and a higher longer-term inflation rate as the global economy adjusts to a new normal. Former Treasurer Peter Costello said markets were probably too optimistic in their view that interest rates had peaked and there was a risk central banks would not start cutting rates as fast as markets were pricing in. In January, Costello said that while inflation was easing, it remained outside the Reserve Bank's target band of 2% to 3%, and that strong labour markets, wage pressures and high energy prices were still feeding into price pressures. BlackRock Global Chief Investment Strategist Wei Lu said the long-term inflation rate would probably settle at a higher annual rate than in the past. 3% is a new 2% in this environment, she said, noting rates were likely to stay higher for longer. And billionaires such as Clive Palmer and Mike Cannon-Brookes will have their influence on politics dramatically curtailed as Labor moves to remove big money donations in the biggest shake-up to Australian election rules in a generation. The Albanese government will shortly begin briefing MPs on its plans to limit the amount donated to parties and candidates in a move that will prove controversial among coalition Greens and independent MPs. In its legislation, the government will also seek to limit the amount spent in each electorate, but the rules will not apply until after the next election, as Labor gives the Australian Electoral Commission time to administer the overhaul and seeks to avoid opposition claims it is trying to game the system to win a second term. Under the proposed changes, an individual company or third-party group who could currently contribute an unlimited amount to a campaign would be banned from giving huge sums to parties, according to government sources. Legislation has not been finalised. The government has not landed a precise figure for the cap, but it is likely to be in the tens of thousands of dollars. Introducing such a cap would mean donations such as the $117 million Palmer gave to the United Australia Party and the $1.2 billion Cannon-Brookes gave to Climate 200 before the last election would no longer be allowed. At the last election, UAP ran candidates in every electorate and won a single Senate seat, while six new Climate 200-backed independents were elected to the lower house, along with one senator and the re-election of four MPs. And there are fears hundreds of billions of dollars worth of looming public infrastructure projects will deepen an already severe shortfall of skilled labour in the construction sector. Over the last few years, the construction sector has taken the brunt of a confluence of factors which created the so-called profitless boom that sparked a surge in insolvencies, including a string of well-known company collapses. Last year, the total share of construction sector administration appointments reached 33% of all company collapses, well above historic highs, as the sector started to slow after a period of surging demand sparked by low interest rates, first homeowner and home builder grants in the residential sector. While some of the issues behind the profitless boom, such as rampant material cost increases and supply chain issues, have settled, demand for skilled labour has never been higher, with a long list of infrastructure projects around the country forecast to suck up skilled tradies. According to Infrastructure Australia, there is a major public infrastructure pipeline valued at $230 billion, while at the same time there's a target of building 1.2 million new homes, as well as major investment in the energy sector. It's said Australia's infrastructure workforce will need to grow by 127% to meet demand. Michael McNabb, Managing Director and Founder of the diversified Southeast Queensland builder McNab, said while the rising construction costs and supply chain issues have settled down, he was concerned over the ambitiously high public infrastructure rollout, and the decline in physical bank branches and ATMs will continue as customers abandon cash transactions, but the move risks marginalising less tax-savvy people or those whose first language is not English. The warning from analysts and industry experts comes as the trend towards shutting branches in the banking sector continues apace. Commonwealth Bank last week said it would close 45 of its Western Australian branches under CBA-owned brand Bankwest and switch to servicing affected customers by digital means only. Since 2017, major banks reported bank closures, including those of Bankwest, have totaled 1,422, according to the Finance Sector Union. The union's National Assistant Secretary, Jason Hall, on Wednesday took aim at CBA and Bankwest, arguing closure of the branches would cost about 350 jobs and disadvantage customers. A range of Bankwest customers will be badly affected, including the most vulnerable in our community, Hall said. Worst affected will be the elderly, First Nations customers, people whose first language is not English, and others who are not computer literate. CBA Group Executive of Retail Banking, Angus Sullivan, said the bank would continue to support customers and employees with 500 roles in technology, operations and customer service to be redirected to WA to support Bankwest's digital transition, and 15 regional Bankwest branches to be converted to CBA branches this year. Treasury estimates reforms, which will come into effect on 1st of July, will ease cost of living costs for business and families to the tune of $120 million over 4 years and raise declining productivity levels. Businesses will save over $30 million in compliance costs per year, says Treasurer Jim Chalmers, adding the tariffs will streamline over $8.5 billion worth of annual trade. From pharmaceuticals to cotton, footwear, toothbrushes and musical instruments, a range of imported goods that often arrive under concessional rates will become easier to import. The reform aims to slash away at excessive red tape in a patchwork system that requires importers to justify their use of tariff concessions. Treasury said the tariffs on targeted imports do nothing to protect Australian businesses since they often arrive under concessional rate. The Productivity Commission defined nuisance tariffs as those that raise minimal revenue for the government, have little benefits for the Australian producers, and impose compliance costs on businesses. Given most affected imports are duty-free, the potential consequences for Australian producers in cutting the tariffs will be minimal, said Treasury. This means that businesses spend time and money proving imports are eligible for existing tax, tariff preferences and concessions, it added. Menstrual and sanitary items will also be affected by the changes, which the government said will align with GST cuts on these goods. In 2022, the Productivity Commission reported that compliance and administrative costs related to proving preferential tariff agreements and concessions are wholly or at least in passed on to consumers. In 2019-20, businesses spent somewhere between $700 million and $2.2 billion on these compliance costs, said the report. In the same financial year, the government raised only $1.5 billion in general tariffs. In 2022-23, the general tariff raised only $1 billion, contributing less than 1% of overall government revenue. Unilateral trade liberalisation has been an ongoing process since at least the 1970s, with a partial exception of recession-era tariff increases in 1975. According to DFAT, the average import-weighted tariff rate applied in Australia fell from above 7% in 1986 to below 1%, while individual tariffs have fallen from a maximum of around 90% to 5%. In 2016, by value, 79% of all imports to Australia attracted no tariff. And Climate Change and Energy Minister Chris Bowen has indicated Labor will soften the edges of its new vehicle emission standard, as he conceded Australia was attempting to introduce a change at a much faster rate than other countries. With a consultation period finished, Mr. Bowen said while the government would not be bullied out of acting, it was prepared to accept changes proposed by those in the industry who backed the need for an emission standard and wanted the scheme to work. Motoring groups and manufacturers accept the need to adopt the standards, but have argued the proposal to force the industry to reduce new car emissions by more than 60% in just 5 years, with little flexibility, will either price out or drive out vehicles from the market before there are affordable and equally capable low-emission alternatives. Most concern centres around utes and SUVs, which are Australia's top-selling vehicle. Under the policy, which begins on January 1st, manufacturers will have to ensure their entire fleet of new vehicles meets an annual emissions cap. There'll be one cap for smaller cars and another for light commercial vehicles, LCVs, such as utes. The caps will be lowered each year until 2029. manufacturers can offset the emissions of their dirtier cars, such as diesel utes, by selling more electric and low-emission vehicles, or buying credits from those who beat the cap, such as EV maker Tesla. Appearing on the ABC's Insiders program, Mr. Bowen did not provide details, but hinted one problem was a proposal to classify large SUVs as passenger vehicles rather than light commercial vehicles, even though SUV models like the Ford Everest and Isuzu MU-X have the same chassis and engine as the respective Ranger and D-Max utes. Mr. Bowen also hinted at applying credits and carve-outs that apply in the US scheme, which Australia is trying to emulate. He accepted the proposed pace of change in Australia may be too ambitious, given the government was trying to catch up after the inaction of its predecessor portion of loans in arrears. And wealthier Australians will pay more for aged care under a long-awaited government review, which calls for retirees to make rental contributions instead of large lump-sum deposits to live in nursing homes. Ruling out a new tax or levy to pay for aged care, as well as any change to means testing on the family home, the review proposed new co-contributions for daily living expenses and accommodation costs in residential facilities. If adopted by Labor, retirees being cared for at home will also pay more through a fee-for-service model, with government funding primarily focused on care provision. The plan aims to stabilise the aged care industry and provide greater choice for retirees and their families. Released by Aged Care Minister Annika Wells on Tuesday, the report said demand for quality services was increasing at the same time as more elderly people had the means to pay more. Healthy superannuation balances and falling reliance on the age pension make the changes possible, the report said. A growing proportion of people aged 85 will have remaining savings in the next two decades, including those with significant funds available. Health Department analysis suggests government spending of $37 billion in 2024 will be required to build the rooms needed for older people by 2050. By 2030, about $5.5 billion will be needed for refurbishment and upgrades, growing to $19 billion by mid-century. Current funding arrangements will not deliver the required amount of capital funding, the report said. Ahead of a demographic time bomb, with a doubling of people older than 65 and the percentage of the population in the workforce falling, Labor is conscious that aged care is politically sensitive. Labor delayed the release of the report until after this month's Dunkley by-election. The plan, designed by an expert task force led by Ms. Wells and former senior Treasury official Nigel Ray, said existing lump-sum payments, known as refundable accommodation deposits, will be phased out by 2035 in favour of a rental-only model. This is a decade later than the phase-out proposed by the 2021 Aged Care Royal Commission, which was deemed too aggressive and would disrupt the sector too much, putting service availability for older people at risk. Under existing rules, the deposits can be used as a significant source of funding for capital investment, acting as an interest-free loan to providers. The deposit is refunded in full when a resident leaves or dies. Moving to a rental-only model would give providers greater certainty about cash flow and remove the risk of insolvency from large liabilities, which can fall due at any time. A periodic rental payment would also support equity in the contribution of residents, the report said. The report warned that existing payments for daily living activities in residential care were causing providers to make a loss of $4 per resident per day. Across the sector, two-thirds of residential aged care providers reported a net loss in 2021-22, equating to a combined $2.26 billion. A new basic daily fee structure is recommended, with a supplement in place to stop providers' banking losses. The cost, currently $61 per day, will continue to be maintained as a percentage of the aged pension. Residents would be able to negotiate a better deal or premium services for a higher fee, with providers required to publish pricing schedules provided participants have already entered care. Currently, the vast majority of aged care costs are met by the federal government. The average contribution of residents is $6,000 a year, and the contribution is capped at $32,000 a year and $76,000 for a lifetime. The federal government's total cost of aged care is projected to surge from $24.1 billion in 2021-22 to an estimated $36 billion in 2023-24 and $42 billion by 2026-27. And communities will be consulted and incentivised to adopt nuclear power, opposition leader Peter Dutton said, as he amplified his case for the energy source to play a central role in reducing its emissions. Mr. Dutton also pledged to ramp up the domestic production of gas to help firm renewable energy. He also hinted at an expansion of rooftop solar, as already flagged by Nationals leader David Littleproud, as an alternative to large-scale renewable energy projects and thousands of kilometres of transmission infrastructure that those will require. In setting the scheme for his nuclear announcement, Mr. Dutton outlined three principles that will guide the fifth policy. First and foremost, we want to get the highest yield of energy using the smallest amount of land, he said. We want to maximise the amount of energy we can obtain per square metre and minimise our environmental footprint. This, he said, will achieve by putting reactors on or near the sites of old coal-fired power stations, as they can use the existing transmission grid. The second principle will involve seeking a social licence for the policy by listening to and incentivising communities to adopt nuclear power. A third principle is that the coalition will put people at the centre of its energy policy by making lower energy bills a key consideration. Mr. Dutton dared the government to lift the nuclear power moratorium and let the market decide. Energy experts continued to cast doubt on the feasibility of the coalition's approach. Carbon Market Institute chair Kerry Schott said she was technology neutral, but nuclear really does not make sense for Australia. Nuclear by far is the most expensive, she said. It really doesn't make sense for Australia because we have so much renewable energy resources. She said firming, wind and solar with hydro and a little bit of gas until hydrogen was commercially available was by far the cheapest and easiest. She did, however, agree that putting solar panels on every rooftop will alleviate the need for Labor's 28,000 kilometres of transmission infrastructure. Mark Hutchinson, chief executive of Fortescue's energy division, backed moving the moratorium on nuclear power, but said the market was unlikely to invest in nuclear power. And that's it for this week. And next week, I'll be talking to Gartner Director of HR Advisory, Neil Woolrich, to talk about the future of work, including remote and hybrid work, strategic workforce, employee experience and engagement. And I'll be talking to ComSec Chief Economist, Craig James, about what's happening in the market in the week ahead. For the most exclusive access to leading economists and business leaders from around the world, subscribe to Talking Business from my website, leongettler.com. If you like Talking Business, please leave us a review with Apple Podcasts. Thank you in advance. In the meantime, catch me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn and YouTube. And if you want, leave a comment. If you want to contact me, email me at leon@leongettler.com. I answer all emails. Wishing you all a safe and healthy week. And looking forward to bringing Talking Business next week.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.